This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Integrating Western science with Indigenous knowledge, our next guest, Dr. Apila Colorado, says humanity's future depends upon it. She's founder of the Worldwide Indigenous Science Network and not too long ago called Juno home. Welcome to the show, Dr. Colorado.
Good afternoon. Really happy to be here.
Thanks. We're happy to have you here. Would you like to introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. I'm Apila Colorado. When I lived here, I didn't use my native name, so people would remember me as Pam Colorado. I am Oneataaga, Oneida tribe, and I am also Gaul or half French. I am a French Indian person.
And are you headed please go ahead.
I forgot to even say, and when I lived here, I was mentored by Chief Donawak, Austin Hammond, Tlingit, and Richard Dalton Sr. of Huna. And I also have a PhD in social policy. I finished writing my dissertation here on the banks of Lemon Creek.
And you're headed back to Juneau this week, is that right?
I am here now.
What brings you back to Juneau, to Tlingit Ani?
What brings me back is probably best described by that certain blue-black radiant bird that caused the raven. My mentors were Raven Clan. I was adopted into the Ravens. And in my new book, Woman Between the Worlds by Hay House, there's three chapters of it set in Juneau, because this was the catalytic nexus of all my life's work. And all these years, I've only been able to come back once or twice. And now here I am back with this book to give thanks for all this land, the majesty, the mountains, the ocean, the ravens, the eagles, the Tlingit, the settler people, all that was given to me. I need to give thanks and want to give thanks for that, particularly to the sites that empowered me, the waterfall, Lemon Creek, the glacier, and the community of people that call themselves Junoites.
I would love to ask you more about the book. You've recently written and published a book called Woman Between the Worlds, A Call to Your Ancestral and Indigenous Wisdom. What is this book about?
The book, the storyline follows my life from childhood to adulthood. And each chapter is set in a different place that I've gone to, as unknowingly and sometimes knowingly, I was going about remembering my Indigenous mind. Growing up between the worlds, neither fully French nor fully American Indian, I was at first in a really marginal, dangerous place. And my journey of life was to bring the two together. The initiation, the energy, the strength to do that came from a ceremony my grandfather did with me when I was about 4 years old, 3 to 4 years old. He took me out under a full lunar eclipse, and there as the darkness descended upon the land and the forest sounds went silent, something happened. I was inducted into the mysteries and I fell asleep on my grandpa's arm. I can still feel the wool of his shirt against my face. I loved him and he loved me. That's what set me on this path. So Woman Between the Worlds, it's tracing a journey through different parts of the earth, through biosystems, through Indigenous cultures, as I'm retrieving the lost parts of myself, but through a long time span. There's a chapter in that sets place in the south of France in the Painted Caves, where now I go for ceremonies annually. The Painted Caves were painted by our Paleolithic ancestors 30 to 40,000 years ago, breathtakingly beautiful, and reminding us how time understood in a linear progression is faulty, and that the whole mind, the womb time, the manava, the sacred time, is what's calling to us now to remember, to renew, to relive. The book is the story about that and what it's meant to do, especially for women and for men who know how to live and embrace the holistic or the context-rich way of knowing and being. We are the people now. The earth is empowering and calling to bring forth this new time, this new cycle, to end the insanity of consumerism and separation set forth in motion in the Industrial Revolution by the Roman Empire, by the Chinese dynasties, all the way back to the point where we came into being. And I also talk in the book about South Africa and visiting the cradle of humankind, where we say the spirit of life became materialized. We put on our animal skins, and now at this time to save the earth, indigenous people will say, we're coming full cycle. The earth is in great changes now between the worlds, therefore the title Woman Between the Worlds. And when this people came, the star beings, the angels, the genetics, however you want to conceive of it, by whatever metaphysical, scientific framework, we came into being, into material form, with a set of instructions, original instructions, and coming full circle now, we begin to bump into those origins, and this is the place where we can renew. It's a time of great possibility, and it's happening right now where COP26 is happening, so perhaps good to have this conversation today.
Your travels alone and the experiences you've had all over the world, especially in these really sacred places, is very inspiring. I'd personally love to see the cave paintings in France myself someday. But in the Juno chapters of your book, what will our readers recognize or be inspired by?
I thought you'd never ask. I'm in the limits of time. How many minutes do I have? I'm trying to decide if I should read something quickly or just paraphrase.
You can read something
quickly.
I'll
read something and then. Okay. All right. So here it is. You'll know that the day was like my mood. Dull gray rain clouds soaked and low. It seemed like they could bump the top of my head. In despair, I dropped to my knees on the cold, damp sand of the riverbank and sobbed. A movement on the far side of the stream caught my attention. I looked up and into the glittery obsidian eye of a huge black raven. He cocked his head to one side as if considering something, and then began shouldering side to side, dancing in an up-to-the-minute raven rhythm. Diffused diamond light of the northern rainforest refracted the glimmer of blue, green, lavender, and gold in the movement of the stark-winged dancer. White raven, a spiritual antecedent and twin to black raven, is known for purity and high-mindedness, while Black Raven is known as a trickster spirit, a demigod in his own right, but full of mischief and trouble. And then I go on and I say, because of bills due and no job, even finishing my PhD and three children to support, and a bill collector just having called me, and now I'm down by the side of the creek and I'm praying, and I look up across the stream at that raven and I say, isn't there a raven who would help me? And then it happens. The words had barely come from my mouth when a sound like a tea towel being snapped cracked behind me. Startled, I jumped to my feet just as a raven hopped up from a side of the stream and took to the air. With extraordinary speed, he came right at me, actually at my inner eye. It happened so fast. And yet I could hear, as if in slow motion, each beat of his broad black wings as he approached, flap, flap, flap. Somehow, the pulse slowed my mind and brought my spirit back into myself. Nothing existed in the moment. About 3 feet above me, he halted midair. He hovered and fanned his wings downward to my upturned face. Instinctively, I raised my arms in prayer, nearly touching the blue-black shining being. He was that close. Tears unbidden streamed down my face as an overwhelming emotion coursed through my body. Then he dropped to chest level about 3 feet out from me and began a slow sunwise circle around my body. A second raven, who I later realized had been standing behind me from the beginning and whose wings snapped open had created the tea towel sound, joined the first raven. They circled my body once, twice, three times in total aerial cacophony. Upside down, sideways, and right side they flew, then apparently satisfied that took off one behind the other toward the Gastineau Channel. I didn't want them to go and started to follow and then stopped myself. Enough is enough, I said to myself, and stood there on the wet sandy bank by myself, laughing, crying, and thanking Raven and anyone else who was listening. So what happened after that, as I'm walking by the side of the creek, I'm gonna go into the house. I look down in the water, and there in a little scooped out place in the soil of the riverbank, which had just been devastated by development. It was just hard pan soil with rain falling on it. And I love this creek because I prayed there every day. I looked down, and in the eddy was a fist-side sweeping of gold dust and gold nuggets.
Whoa.
The answer to my prayers. Yeah. And then I have to decide to take it or not to take it. And if I'm going to take it, how can I? If I run back up to the house and get a pan, no, then the gold might be swept away. But then what kind of pan? Well, oh, wait, I have an artist painted gold pan. I could get that. Surely that would do it. No, I can't. There's no time in it. And I'm going back and forth. And then I look at the river and how devastated it is. And I see if I get this gold, even if I succeed in panning it, I have to turn it in to get cash for it. And then I have to identify where I got it. I look at the side of the riverbank and say, I can't do it. I can't do it. As bad as I need the money, I can't do it. And then I just turned and walked to the house. But for years, I asked myself, should I have taken that gold or not? Was Raven answering my prayers and giving me this gold? Or like, was I just like stupid and lacking gold pan confidence? I didn't get it. Or what, you know, and Raven is a trickster. So you have to be careful. Like, was it a test of my integrity? Or was it a test of I'm trying to help you and pick up on it, Colorado, right? So it was 20 years later, I was up in Anchorage and I was talking to two Native Athabascan friends. And I said to this elder over sourdough pancakes, so what do you think? Should I have taken the gold or not? That's Raven, right? Stays with you forever with a trickster. And she looked at me and she said, what happened next? And what happened next was phenomenal, but you will have to get the book to know what happened next.
I was hoping that you would leave us hanging and leave us wanting a little more. Well, that's absolutely enchanting. Thank you for sharing that portion of your book and that personal story of yours. Where can we get a hold of a copy of your book? Where is it available?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and it's out by Hay House. I'm Juno and the Ravens going all over the world. The book is published in Sydney and Singapore and I don't know, India, London, all over the place. If I sell 10 copies, I'll be really happy. So help me out, gang.
Well, what is next?
Raven Pride.
What's next for you, Dr. Colorado, and also for Worldwide Indigenous Science Network?
Worldwide Indigenous Science Network is in January opening a master's and PhD program with United Nations University in Costa Rica. And it's a place where people from every race, nationality, walk of life can get a master's or a PhD in Indigenous Science and Peace Studies. The earth mind, or the context-rich Indigenous mind, is a birthright for every human being on earth. And here's a place where Indigenous elders and Western scientists will help us to do that. We also continue our work. We have a network of Indigenous shamans and elders from around the world, and we work to keep that knowledge alive. And increasingly, because of the pressures on Indigenous people, you know, we have like something like 80% of the world's biodiversity remains on the Indigenous lands. So more and more Indigenous elders are being targeted and murdered because they can connect us to that way of knowing and being. I mean, here in Juneau, it's so beautiful. Like the land, you know, the mountains are just right in front of you. It just holds you and touches you, and the rains and the wind. So we're already 80% of the way into the Indigenous science mind. So open up, own our ancestry and come back into the fold. The earth needs it. We need it to survive.
Well, I really want to thank you for your time today, Apila Colorado, Dr. Apila Colorado, founder of Worldwide Indigenous Science Network and author of Women Between the Worlds, A Call to Your Ancestral and Indigenous Wisdom. Thanks for talking to me today.
Gunas chish.
I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and here with me now is Sergeant Chris Gifford from the Juneau Police Department, checking in with us for November updates. Hello, Sergeant Gifford.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. But your department is coming off of a search and rescue effort over the Halloween weekend, on top of an open investigation into the disappearance of Doug Farnsworth. Is there any information you'd like to share with our listeners about the course of events?
I think that while it was an unfortunate ending for the incident out at Dredge Lakes, it was handled in coordination with the Alaska State Troopers and Sea Dogs and the U.S. Coast Guard and U.S. Forest Service. Everybody came together really quickly, got involved in that really quickly. And I think, unfortunately, the man was found no longer living. I think all those agencies did a really good job, in addition to the volunteers that were involved with it. So I think that we did I'd like to say thank you to all those agencies that helped us.
Sure. And add to that, there was some very dark and foggy weather that night on Halloween, Sunday and Monday. It really set me on edge. So I don't know about you, but increased pedestrian traffic plus like terrible visibility just seemed like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Otherwise, Halloween went off pretty safely. And thank you to everyone in Juneau that, gave trick-or-treats out to the kids and made sure they drove safely and watched for people on the road. And I think it was a good time. We had a lot of trick-or-treaters in my house.
I had two. Well, that might be a good segue into my next question. It does seem like your department can use all the help you can get. Not that you're not doing a great job. It's just that in recent years, you've really put a lot of effort into recruiting new officers. And citizen academies and junior cadet academies have been one way to generate interest in a law enforcement career. How successful have those been?
Well, we've got a Citizens Academy that's underway right now. I think there's about 10 people in there, and these are people from Juneau that want to come and are just interested to see how Juneau Police Department runs and what happens within the department. So these people come in, and I think they go through about 8 weeks or 2 months, meeting once a week on Thursday evenings for a couple of hours, and just learning about the hiring process for new police officers, and then what day-to-day things the police officers that work here, the dispatchers, the support staff that we have all do. And I think it's kind of a pretty good program, because looking through it, there are some things that I would like to go to, because I don't know how everything in this department works. For instance, we have a bomb team that responds when some sort of suspicious package or something like that appears, and they're trained over the course of their careers to work on stuff like that, or like the computer forensics unit that goes with computer crime, be it like financial fraud type stuff, or things that aren't supposed to be on computers and things of that nature. I don't know how any of that works. So they get a little bit of a taste of each one of those, and we have our specialists at the department teach each one of those courses. So that's been going on for, I think they're about halfway into that. I think tomorrow, I think they're gonna be talking about use of force, which of course is one of the most important and critical things that we deal with. So that's what they'll be doing tomorrow. We're shooting for early 2022 to begin our cadet program. And the cadet program is going to be new. It's going to be something that we haven't done in over 20 years, where we're going to be able to have kids that 16 to 17 year olds and 18, 19 year olds, basically ages 16 to 20, can, if they're interested, can partake in our department and have some training and be part of our organization, ride along with some of our patrol officers, and kind of learn the basics of policing and community service and public service. They're going to be learning things like history of law enforcement, the Pelayan principles, which you know, are basically that the community is the police and the police are the community. I think that those are very important things to learn in order to have a good police department. But we're going to teach them some hands-on stuff too. We're going to teach them things like photography. One of the things I like about that is you know, even if the person, you know, goes on to do something else, they can still learn how to use a camera and how to photograph a crime scene, which can then translate into maybe something artistic or something later on. They'll learn about communications, which is really important for us. So we are a very spread out police department, and we have to be able to communicate via radios and even hand signals or something. Sometimes they'll learn some of that. They'll learn about criminal law, accident investigation, directing traffic. One of the things I like about accident investigation in particular with young adults and kids is it reminds them that there are aspects of this job in, for instance, accident investigation, that they got to know math. So, you know, keep studying, stay in school, and do the best you can as far as that. I was never very good at math, but there is a need for it. And we have some police officers that are very good at math, and they're the ones that go out and take all the measurements and make all the calculations and things like that. So we're pretty excited about that program. We hope to have that off and running soon, and we'll be looking for people that are interested soon. We're looking for people that, you know, you don't have to be really super good in school, but, you know, are doing good in school, or have the recommendation of a counselor or something like that. You know, a general good character. No one's perfect. You don't have to be perfect, but we want people that are interested and that will put forth a good representation of our department, because they're going to be part of our department. And so I'm excited for that. And I know a lot of the other police officers are also excited for that. Even today, I got an email from one of our officers. Is like, hey, I think this is a great thing. What can I do to help? So we have many, many police officers here jumping at the bit to help out. So it's exciting, and I'm really glad, and I think it's going to be pretty cool.
Over the next course of the year, or the course of these programs, how many new officers do you hope will join the department as a result of these efforts?
The Juneau Police Department did this in the early 1990s, and I know that because I was part of it. There are three of us that were former police cadets. I started in 1993 when I was a senior in high school, and I did it for about a year. And Sergeant Dominic Branson was also a part of that program, as was Lieutenant Jeremy Wesky. So there are three of us that work here now that did it. And that's out of, you know, I don't know how many kids, but quite a few. Some of them may have gone on to work at other places. But if we can get three more you know, 10 or 15 years, that would be, or less maybe, that would be great. Even if we're not successful in hiring a bunch of new people, I think it's still good, gives people a great opportunity to come in and just learn about us and for us to have some new potential recruits to hang out with and stuff. I think it's overall, even if it doesn't turn into a major recruitment tool, it's just a good thing to do.
I understand you're welcoming a new officer in Sitka, Alaska. What's the connection between that hire and Juneau Police Department?
Officer Taylor Davis came to us from Houston, Texas, with his wife Amber, and a German Shepherd and a cat. And he came up here, I believe, his wife is a TSA employee. And so they both came here. He ended up getting hired here, and he's about halfway into his training. He'll be back from the academy soon. He's a little bit about him. He really likes sports, really likes sports, and his household gets pretty intense over sports. Both he and his wife really enjoy fishing. They like hiking. They really like Juneau, and they're new to Juneau, but they're really happy to be here and really excited to be here. We also have another new hire named Chris Herrick. Officer Herrick just moved here from Montana, but he did live here. I think he went to Ocbay Elementary a long time ago. He's a graduate of CU Boulder. He likes to fish. He likes skiing. He also is very, very excited to be here. And we have two other officers that we just got done with training. They're out on their own now. Within the last month, they have finished their training, and that's Officer Owen Walsh and Officer Austin Thomas. And Officer Thomas is also a TMHS grad, so he's raised locally here, and it's good to see him on the streets here in Juneau.
Right. Maybe one day when they're a little less green, they can take their turn providing the monthly update on Juneau Afternoon.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
Sergeant Gifford, you'd mentioned that some of the things that cadets and other and the Citizen Academy attendees are learning would be great to learn yourself. Do you guys have ongoing opportunities for career development for current officers?
We do, and it's we're a small department, so it's really hard for someone to sit back and not take on any of those extra duties, because they're all we have to do those, because we're the only law enforcement agency in Juneau, and we're not accessible from other places. And so there's just lots, and everyone seems to take kind of a career path around here, and their training and their specialties go in the gaps that need to be filled. And there's always gaps that need to be filled, because, you know, people work in this profession from 20 or 30 years and then move on to retirement or other things. And so there's people that need to fill those positions. So there really is one of the things that, you know, for the first 2 years of a police officer's career, is just kind of getting to know the other officers and what they do and their specialties, and then trying to figure out where that fits for them in their career and how they're going to manage that in the future.
Well, thanks so much for your time today and for answering all of my questions, Sergeant Chris Gifford with the Juneau Police Department. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience before we say goodbye today?
No, thanks. I think that we're all really excited, though, to start this cadet program here. And so if you know someone that might be interested, by all means, let them know that we're looking for people, and then they can get in touch with me, and we can get them maybe ready to go here in the next few months.
Sounds good. Well, I'm happy to help you spread the word, and thanks again for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Take care. This is Juneau Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Adak seems to be the land that time forgot, an island in the Aleutians that once housed over 6,000 people. Today, only about 75 people call Adak home, a haunting backdrop for Ben Huff's photography, part of a new exhibit opening this Friday at the Alaska State Museum. Joining us now to talk about the exhibit, Jackie Manning, curator of exhibitions at the Alaska State Museum. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Ben Huff, the photographer himself, with a long list of photo credits under his belt. Hi, Ben.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Ben, let's start with you. Many of our listeners do know you, but would you please introduce yourself for those who don't?
Ben Huff, local artist, photographer. Second exhibition with the State Museum. Had my last one in, was it 13 or 14, with the project The Last Road North in the old building, and super excited to be in the new space. I think the show looks great. Thanks to Jackie and Aaron.
How did this photography project come about? What was the inspiration? Is it something you'd been planning for a long time?
I've been thinking about it for a really long time. Yeah, I kind of stumbled across ADAC in a history book. I think Steve Cohen was the author. It was a three-volume set called The Forgotten War, about the World War II campaign in the Aleutians. This is when, like in 08, when I was living in Fairbanks, working on The Last Road North, which was the last show I showed at the State Museum. The last book had some contemporary pictures of ADAC, and I was just completely struck by this, you know, the pictures were of town, and really struck by this sort of town that looked like, I mean, anywhere in the Midwest that I grew up in Iowa, that was sitting out in the Aleutians, this place that was sort of, you know, mythical and grand, and thought then that that would be sort of a really nice next project to follow the project I was working on the Hall Road at the time, and kind of put that in my pocket and talked about it a bit and thought about it a lot and did a bunch of research, but didn't make my first trip until the summer of 2015, finally, finally kind of, you know, realized that you know, that notion or whatever it was to, you know, in 08 or so, to plan it and say, this is going to be a thing one way or another, I'll figure out how to make this work. And made my first trip in 15, and then kind of wrapped it up right before kind of the pandemic hysteria hit us all. Hmm.
So what is the story that your exhibit is telling? What do you hope viewers will feel and experience as they progress through?
That's a great question. I think I feel an experience. I love that way of thinking about it. I don't know that there's necessarily something that I'm wanting people to learn. I'm as confounded by the place now as I think I was the first time I went in 2015, right? But it's contemporary pictures of this place that, you know, housed 6,000 people at one point during the Cold War and is now, completely, you know, decimated by wind and rain and the elements, and to be quite honest, vandals who have come through over the years, sort of crossed with these people that have come after the fact, after the Navy moved out in 97 to sort of, you know, find the American dream and these fine, you know, these small little ranch houses out in the middle of the Aleutians. But it's also crossed with these archival images from the Alaska State Library and from the Anchorage Museum archives of some of that conflict, you know, submarines. It was a nuclear submarine surveillance island or site during the Navy, when the Navy was there during the Cold War. So there's these pictures of history, these pictures of conflict, these pictures of the reason the island's there, and then these contemporary pictures that are sort of empty and sort of run down and you know, not boom but bust, and I think point to a lot of things and ills and situation that we live sort of in our contemporary world. It's not, you know, it's not end times, but it's, and it's not, I don't think of it as being, it's sort of our time, but it's not journalism. It's something I hope people can come and sit with and come away with, with something substantial, but I'm not trying to tell them what that thing is, I guess.
What is your sense of what life was like in ADAC during those Cold War years for the people who lived there, the thousands of people who lived there?
The military built it up, right? I mean, there was a McDonald's, you know, there was a bowling alley, there was the only 50 meter or 50 yard, I think probably at the time, swimming pool in the entire state, right? I think if you just sort of had your head down and you were there in town, it probably felt like anywhere USA, right? Like that's sort of the military's job, is to make it feel that way. There was no, you know, actual boots on the ground conflict on the island. So I think it probably felt relatively safe, you know? It probably felt like a very noble, important cause being out there. It's funny, I mean, I could walk around those neighborhoods, and if you don't sort of, you know, lift your head up and catch the horizon line and, you know, catch the other islands that are sort of, you know, just off the shore, sort of neighboring to the east and the west there along the chain, you could sort of feel like you were anywhere else other than, you know, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I always found that sort of fascinating.
What about for the folks who didn't live in the neighborhood, who lived there before the Army came in, who are still there now? For them?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there were Aleuts on the along the entire chain at Attu and Kiska, ADAC, who were moved out by the initial World War II conflict. There's not the folks that are living there now. I don't want to speak to everyone that's living there now by any stretch, but I don't think that there is certainly a native, you know, claim to the space, and there's history. Most of those folks are sort of coming back to a place that didn't exist for them during the war years, if that makes sense.
We have an image up on the website, kto.org/JunoAfternoon, Kuluk Bay neighborhood, Sweeper Cove, 2017. What can you tell me about that shot?
That picture sort of sums up, I think, a lot of that, of not the military complexes, but a lot of that sort of neighborhood situation. There's one building right in the middle that on the stovepipe, there's this little blue bucket. A friend of mine, Larry Hodge, spends summers out there and lives in that little space. And off to the right, there's a couple of people that lived in some houses that are kind of just out of frame on the right. But for the most part, in all the white house or the yellow houses, excuse me, that are on the horizon are unoccupied. So of the probably 100 houses that are in that frame, maybe four or five of them have people living there. And even like Larry is just there seasonally. So I'd made a bunch of pictures of the water tower, the hill that the water tower on is the hill that I'm standing on. And I'd made several pictures sort of from that vantage point. That early morning after a snow, that sort of, you know, lack of stovepipe smoke, the lack of any, you know, tire tracks on the street, the lack of footprints, the sort of, you know, you can kind of see the harbor and sort of more, you know, industrial stuff in the distance. There's such a lack of life, which isn't necessarily the case, but the picture speaks to that emptiness in a way that I had taken probably half a dozen pictures at different seasons that didn't quite sort of just photographically, just visually sort of check the boxes.
The exhibit is called Atomic Island, and I understand there will be a book as well. Is that available now?
It's not available yet. No, we hoped so much to have it for the exhibition. It's sort of a casualty of supply chain issues due to the pandemic. The publisher that's publishing the book, FW Books in Amsterdam, brilliant designer Hans Gremmen, has sort of made the book really sort of the true embodiment of what this work really is, 75 or so pictures. But it's held up at the press, it's in queue and will be printed soon, whatever soon means. You know, the show runs through January, it comes down January 29th. I'm really hoping at one point to be able to have the book there at the museum and to have a signing and to maybe have an event. You know, it's available for pre-order. People can kind of get their name on the few copies that I'll have here in town that I can sell out of my studio. It'll be available worldwide through the publisher at some point, but it's forthcoming. That's about the best I can say right now.
So the exhibit opens this first Friday. Jackie, how was Ben's exhibit, how did it come to be selected for display at the State Museum?
Well, every few years, the museum opens up. We accept applications from all over the state, artists from all over the state, and a committee reviews those. And we have, for the 2020 through 2023 grouping, we've got a great group of artists, six artists that were selected, and Ben Heff was one of them, and really excited to have this exhibit, because like you said, last one he had at the museum back in 2014, I think he had just got his ticket or was just about to get his ticket to go out to ADAC for the first time, yeah. So yeah. Fun to, you know, all this time later, see this work that he's been working on since his last show.
Have you seen the full array of images that Ben has chosen?
Yes, we have. The show is up and lit, and we're working on some last few details, and it's stunning. Like you said, it's the variety and how much I've learned about ADAC. There's just some beautiful photographs. I think the word you said earlier was haunting images, and I think it'll be a show that will be really well received, and we appreciate that it's here.
What is planned for the exhibit opening this first Friday, this Friday?
So the exhibit opens at 4:00, and first Fridays are free at the museum. So from 4 until 6, please come and see the exhibit. And then at 6:00, Ben will give a lecture in the lecture hall. We will, due to COVID, we're going to just keep an eye on numbers, and we'll have limited seating in the lecture hall. But if you don't make it in, due to keeping the numbers down, We are going to have that recorded and available on KTO later on. So we'll get that address out as soon as we have it.
Jackie Manning, Ben Huff, thank you so much for talking with me today. Anything else you'd like to share before we say goodbye?
If I could, I just want to plug, Ben is also doing a youth activity on Saturday, November 20th. From 1 till 3, and there's still spaces available. So if you know students that are interested in learning photography, that sounds like a very exciting youth activity that he's going to be giving then. November 20th, you can sign up online at the lamb.alaska.gov/youthart.
That's great, Ben. Thanks for doing that.
Yeah.
Well, thanks both of you for your time today, and best of luck with the exhibit and the opening this Friday.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.
You as well. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. In just a few days, music history will be made in Tlingit'ani, which is the host for the first Indigenous music festival of its kind. Joining us now to talk about that and upcoming arts and culture events is Nancy DeCherney, Executive Director for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks for being back on the show. This is it. We've been talking about it and waiting for it for so long, and now Rock Ock is finally happening the day after tomorrow. Are you excited?
Yes, it's very exciting. We got the lineup, so you know what time to see everybody. It's on the Rock Ock website. We just got a call from Metlakatla. They're sending in a donation, so they're going to stream the thing during their high school dance Friday night. So
that's so cool.
I know, Good News Bay is doing this. So it's all over the state, and it's just going to be wonderfully exciting. And I encourage, we have Crystal Worrell opening in our first Friday, but at 4 o'clock before First Friday is the opening ceremony for the Rock Ock Festival. Paul Marks will be there doing the call and the welcome, and it'll be in front of the Elizabeth Pradovich mural with Crystal Worrell's mural. So come on down to that and get ready for this whole weekend of really wonderful things. It runs from 7 p.m. to 10 o'clock on Friday night and from 7 until about 10:30 on Saturday night. The lineup is amazing. Go to the website and you can see that. So that's lots to do, but also on Friday night, as I said, we've got Crystal Worrell's new solo exhibit in our gallery. If you don't feel like going out and about, and we do ask that if you come to our exhibits in person, masks and proof of vaccination. We keep everybody, 6 feet apart. It's a little dance. And there are a couple of the artists that are coming that will have merch, the infamous merch. So you can stop in and see that as well.
So the Rock Ock merch will be available at the Jack Gift Shop?
Yep.
Great.
And after, we're doing an after hours with Ashley Lohr of the Rosie Finn store in Petersburg. She's an about how she does her process or learn more about her. That will be released on our box on the Arts Council website starting first Friday. So check that out. The Juno Douglas City Museum has Jessica Hamlin. She does beautiful silk screens and watercolor stuff. So check her out. I think she's going to be running from November 5th to December 31st. Lots of really wonderful stuff there. Barnaby Brewing's got Lavender Peaks Photography through the month. I want to also say Perseverance Theater's show is really wonderful. I got to go see it on Saturday. Great music, uplifting storyline. Take a moment to go to live theater on that sort of thing. I mean, how long has it been? Anyway, and then the Juno Artist Gallery has Sunny Zhang. She's a painter and mixed artist, and her stuff will be up through the month, but you can visit with her from 4:30 to 6 in the Senate building. So there's plenty of things to do there. I also want to mention, we are doing Gallery Walk. I get a few calls about what's the deal with Gallery Walk. Well, we're planning to do Gallery Walk. And Laura, who is our artist and gallery manager, is going to offer a workshop on the 16th. If you're interested on how to actually do a successful gallery exhibit. So she's got tips and ideas and is happy to share that with you. It'll be a Zoom thing on the evening of the 16th. So you can register for that and, you know, let it get the first Friday galleries and the gallery walks back up and running. It's, you know, it's been so long, I forget how to do anything. You know, like I forgot to wear shoes, whatever. We also have a live workshop coming up on the 18th, wreath making, so for the holidays with Miss Scarlett. So people interested in getting ready for that, give that a look. What else you got, Shelley? Anything you need to talk about? I feel like I'm running through it really, really fast.
Well, and I'm taking notes here. So my first question is, if I missed any of that, where can I go to see it all somewhere?
You can come to the jahc.org. There's a community calendar there, and then there's buttons to push to get tickets, and there's buttons to push for, you know, seeing the calendar and all that sort of stuff. If you want to have your items on the calendar, be sure to send us a note or let us know. We are back to doing postering, so if you do your postering through us, it gets added to the calendar as well. So slowly we're all coming, it's coming alive. It's amazing that it's almost the middle of November.
Good you heaven. Said gallery walk, and I just had a little moment of panic. That's going to be in a month. I'll be doing so many interviews.
I know. And we, you know, it's one of the things I want to do this year is just get it kind of organized ahead of time and just relax and enjoy the whole experience. Just will be great to see everybody and just take time. That's one of the things we've learned, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to take some time.
Well, it just sounds like there's a lot of fun stuff coming up. So I'm glad to hear that. And your excitement, your enthusiasm is contagious. So thanks for that.
Sure. Thank you for having us all on. And I hope to see if the way to get to see the Rock Ox stuff is to make a small donation, whatever you can afford. The link is on our website, and you'll get the link emailed to you. And then it's good for both nights. And it's two different shows.
So, can I ask you something about that? There was raffle tickets on one of those options, but it looks like those may be sold out.
I think I may have three. We're doing the final count, and then we'll see. But we are just about sold out on raffle tickets. And we'll do the raffle drawing on Sunday at 3 o'clock. I think it'll live stream to probably our YouTube or maybe our Facebook page. I don't remember which.
So we should call you if we want that ticket, huh?
Yes.
All right, Nancy DeCherney, thanks so much. Thanks for everything you've done. Really looking forward to Rock Ox this weekend, starting Friday at 7 o'clock. So thanks for that. And also have a great first Friday.
You too. Thank you, Shelley.
Take care.